the official Coast Guard song sends us into our first segment today. It's titled Semper Paratus, which is Latin for always ready. And I think that's pretty appropriate as we talk about the U.S. Coast Guard. It operates in all 50 states, has a district dedicated to the entirety of the Great Lakes and the St. Lawrence Seaway. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today as we talk about the Coast Guard's mission to protect boaters, enforce the laws on our largest inland seas with our guest, Lieutenant Phil Gertler. He is a public affairs officer with the 9th Coast Guard District External Affairs Division based at the Command Center in Cleveland, Ohio. And as we talk with him, I hope you'll join in. What are your thoughts about serving in the Coast Guard? In addition to its peacetime duties, how does it support combat missions involving the U.S. Navy? Maybe you have experienced something that has involved the Coast Guard. Maybe you were once a member. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or you could send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Lieutenant Philip Gertler, welcome to the show. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you very much for having me be involved in this. As a Wisconsin native, I've spent a couple of summers working the farm listening to WPR, so I'm real happy to be involved and kind of giving back to it.
Well, thanks so much, Phil. Let's do a big picture first, kind of. What's the mission of the U.S. Coast Guard?
So the mission of the U.S. Coast Guard is we're very unique in what we do. We're kind of military, we're kind of law enforcement, we're a lot of humanitarian, but it really stems from, really since the founding of the United States, and in 1790, the founding of the Revenue Cutter Service, and that's really where we go back to as kind of our birth, and that is, frankly, making sure that we're enforcing tariffs, doing things like that on the coasts. But as technology progresses, as culture progresses, lighthouses become a thing, steamboats become a thing, and there are these smaller organizations that are created federally, Steamboat Inspection Service, Lighthouse Service, Life-Saving Service, and it just kind of made sense in 1915 to put them together into one organization, the U.S. Coast Guard. So our missions range from, you know, we assist Customs and Border Patrol, we guard the coast itself, but we also do aids to navigation. That's stemming from the lighthouses of, you know, buoys, day markers, things like that, making sure that really the waterways of the United States are safe. But we also have law enforcement, migrant interdiction. We, as an organization, we have a lot of hats. But we're really happy that we have those capabilities to go out and do those missions. Yep. And then the big one that everyone thinks about, obviously, is, especially in the Great Lakes, is search and rescue.
Which you do a lot of, apparently. And, you know, somebody might, and we can talk about that as we move along today, but somebody might ask, well, what's the difference between the Coast Guard and our Navy?
One, want to make it perfectly clear that we are the longest continuing service, or continuously serving seagoing service. The Navy was abolished for a couple of years. So nothing against the Navy, but just want to throw that out there. But a lot of that difference really does kind of boil down to we are more paramilitary, whereas the Navy is a military branch. There's a couple of cool things that come along with that. We are Department of Homeland Security versus Department of Defense. And really it is more of that Homeland Security mission, national security mission. We do have Coast Guard members that are forward deployed on Navy vessels. We call them LEADETs or law enforcement detachments because there are certain things that a Coast Guard cutter can do for law enforcement than that a Navy vessel may not be able to. So having those detachments on board, they will lead that law enforcement party and it will actually be a Coast Guard mission in support of the Navy. But we also do have, you know, some of our deployable special operations units. Coast Guard specialty really is more of the shallow water. My sister was actually deployed to Bahrain, where she assisted with protection of some of the different oil platforms out there, because there's a lot of nations out there that, you know, they want to have the capability of protecting their borders, but having a full-fledged Navy just doesn't make sense for them. So we work with a lot of these international partners to help establish and run their Coast Guard, which gives them the capabilities they're looking for without having to, you know, have a full blue water Navy.
Phil, you mentioned your sister, and it got me thinking, all right, this is almost like a family affair here. How did you get in? How did you get involved? It was, you know, does this go back before your time within your family?
My sister and I are actually the first two since the Civil War in my family to serve. But as for what really got me into it, probably too much Captain America as a kid. I'd wanted to serve, but really it was the Coast Guard's mission, that humanitarian side, kind of more of the shield versus the sword, that really drew me to it.
Yeah, I can see why. The 9th District. How big is the 9th Coast Guard District?
So the 9th Coast Guard District is, well, just talking a little bit about the Great Lakes, it's 21% of the world's fresh water. There's more than 34 million people that live in the Great Lake Basin. It is 8 U.S. states, 2 Canadian provinces, 42 different tribal nations, and, you know, you can't count the number of local governments that are in those areas as well. The Great Lakes are huge. It is one of our Coast Guard districts. So you go sector, we have 4 sectors that are covering each one of the individual lakes. Then you have district, which is covering all of those together. And then the next step up is all of land area, basically cut the U.S. in half, the land area and PAC area, Pacific area.
That's a lot of area.
Yeah.
So the number of people, you must have a fair number of people operating on this. Let's zero in maybe a bit on Lake Michigan, Lake Superior, because that's what's bordering our state.
Mm-hmm. So we are, as a Coast Guard as a whole, we're about 30 to 40,000 people, you know, fluctuates. When it comes down to specifically sector Lake Michigan, you know, we have 7 small boat stations that dot the lake going all the way around. We have 2 aids to navigation teams. These are the ones their specialty is, you know, buoys, things like that. And then we have 3 units that their specialty is more the pollution response. But there can't be more than 1,000 folks all around Lake Michigan. We're a bit of a small service. We do a lot with what we have, but that's kind of always been what we're known for. So we that's something we take pride in, is being as efficient as possible.
Yeah. Well, I know the 9th Coast Guard District's Lake Michigan sector operates out of Milwaukee primarily. What kinds of situations does the sector handle?
So the sector is, like I said, it covers the entirety of the lake.
Yeah.
And that is really the control center for the lake. So it's operational, but also a lot of the logistical sides of things. So we have facility engineers that are there. We have logistic folks, the YN, the yeomans, who are our paperwork folks, our storekeepers, the ones who do the purchasing. So anything that you can really think of logistically, they're going to support there. Operationally, that is where Lake Michigan's primary command center is. And what is in the command center is, it's a lot of folks, their specialties, they're called operational specialists. And their whole career path, all of their training is, how do I take information from a caller? You know, think of it kind of as a dispatch. I'm getting either a call on the radio, I'm getting a call directly from somebody who's on a boat that's sinking, I'm getting a call from 911 because, you know, that's the number that people call right away when they're in trouble. And they can take that information. We've got a couple of really cool computer programs that let us generate a search area, you know, probabilities. Where is it going to be the best chance to search when we send out our assets? What assets are available? And then they can take that information and they say, you know, there is a case that is off of, you know, Navy Pier down in Chicago. Okay, Station Chicago is going to be the best asset. And then they work with that small boat station to actually affect the rescue.
Wow. There's a lot that's going on there.
Yes.
Out of Milwaukee, give me some numbers for, if you can, search and rescue cases, law enforcement boardings every year. What have you got?
So for total number of cases out just in Lake Michigan last year, we had 1,023. So that is search and rescue, law enforcement, pollution, things of that nature. Specifically for search and rescue, they had 597 search and rescue cases.
Wow.
And in those 500, so just shy of 600, they assisted 730 people, which assisted can mean something as simple as we got a report, we came out there, they ran out of gas, we sat with them until they were able to get towed or whatever it is. But we had 329 lives saved. And what that metric is that specifically is if but for direct Coast Guard intervention, highly likely that that individual would not have survived.
Wow.
So Coast Guard units saved 329 lives last year just in Lake Michigan.
So it's practically one life a day.
Just about. D9 is kind of an interesting situation. We are usually number two or number three for search and rescue cases in the Coast Guard by all the districts. However, our boating season, as you know, is incredibly short. So we are getting, you know, equal number of cases as East Coast, West Coast, but we're doing it in 3 months versus 12.
Oh, man. You got to be on your toes and ready to go. There are lots more I want to talk with you about today, Phil. And we'll let our listeners join in. Do you have a question or a comment, or maybe you've been involved in one of these search and rescue operations yourself? I hope you'll join in. Number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. Love to hear from you. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on Wisconsin Public Radio News. Great to have you with us as we talk about the Coast Guard. I want to just mention our June member drive is quickly approaching. We have a special challenge to meet that goal. You can be one of 500 people who donate before the 27th of June, and a generous group of members are going to add an additional $10,000 for WPR programs. You can join in now at WPR.org/donate. Become one of those first 500. That's WPR.org/donate. Love to hear from you for that. And love to hear from you with questions about the Coast Guard or maybe an experience to share. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you can email us to talk@WPR.org. talk@WPR.org. I was reading online, Phil, and there was a little story about this past Memorial Day where the Coast Guard at the Lake Michigan Command Center in Milwaukee helped rescue a guy who was stuck on a sinking sailboat. And that was that a typical? I think that involved a helicopter.
Yes, it did. That's a very typical phone call that we get is, you know, Mayday, Mayday, my vessel's going down. And again, those folks in the command center, they take that information, they figure out, okay, the call came from this area, they can triangulate some of that information, and then they'll work with the air stations who respond to this, and then also the small boat stations to get out there as quickly as possible to effect the rescue. But that, as for, that is very much a routine call that we get.
Oh man, if I'm not mistaken, I mean, you pulled him out just before the boat sank.
Yes, that is something that does come up occasionally. Is, you know, we are very much rescue the people. If the vessel has to go down, it's people first. Weirdly enough, we actually see this the most with ice rescue, where some city will, almost every year we have a call of, you know, there's a big ice fishing tournament and somebody looks up from their hole and sees that the shoreline is moving away from them. I think last year we pulled 60 people off of one ice floe. And you go out there and you rescue them and they're super happy, but it's what about my ice shack? Well, we are here to rescue you.
Can you airlift my ice shack?
Yeah.
I'll sit in it while you do it. Oh, my gosh. Well, you know, you're going to avoid. Let's take the sailboat. If you're going to avoid life-saving situations like this. And by the way, I don't know. You have probably swam in Lake Michigan. I've dipped my toes in there, too. And it's cold. And you're not going to last very long.
No, and that's one of the biggest things that we run into is it's twofold. One, people look at the weather and they say it's 70 degrees out. That's an awesome day to be at, you know, out on the water, not realizing that early summer, you know, while that water could still be 40, 45 degrees cold. That's cold,
yes.
And that can actually put you in a dangerous situation. But on the reverse side of that. There are people, unfortunately, that seem to think, oh, you know, hypothermia is going to, that's what's going to kill me right away. So they're not wearing life jackets. But we're finding that wearing a life jacket that's properly fitted, that it's a Coast Guard approved life jacket, really is one of the biggest determining factors. If you find yourself in a situation like this, where you're in the water, that's going to keep you alive long enough for us to come out and get to you.
Yeah, and that Coast Guard approved, you know, I've always looked for that Coast Guard approval stamp or whatever on any flotation device that I've ever purchased. How do you have any idea the kind of process you go through for something like that to get a Coast Guard approval?
We work very closely with some of our different partners in the industries. You know, if I'm a life jacket manufacturer, I know that if I don't get that Coast Guard approval, my life jackets aren't going to sell. So there's a real good working relationship between a lot of those commercial entities and the Coast Guard to make sure that they're meeting the standards. One of the big things is making sure that it's properly fitted, making sure that it's made out of the right materials. So as for how that process actually looks like, no idea. We have an entire legal department that is responsible for that, and God bless them.
Oh, man.
Thank you.
Sort of like the good housekeeping seal of approval, you know? To see that Coast Guard approved, you know it's going to be okay. Jeff in McFarland has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Jeff.
Hello. So this is a short sea story from back in about 78, I was in the Coast Guard on a 180-foot buoy tender icebreaker out of Sturgeon Bay. It was the Acacia. And, you know, our mission normally was to, as he described earlier, to take care of buoys, pull them out for the winter and put them back in the spring and ice break. But we got a call, I think it was October. It was really getting cold and we had about 10-foot seas. We were in northern Lake Michigan. We got a call of a pleasure craft going down. And I bring this up because it just gives an example of some of the Coast Guard assets. So it was a family about four, and they were sinking their seal along their prop shaft was leaking, and they had cognitively impaired child on there, and one person was seasick. And so myself and another lieutenant, junior grade, put on the wetsuits, jumped over, swam over, and then the helicopter out of Traverse City lowered down. This is It was just getting dark, lowered down. It was called a P250 pump. You could pump 250 gallons a minute. And got that going and got them dewatered, then got them towed in, and it worked out fine. But just an example of the coordination of, you know, normally 180-foot ship like that, we wouldn't do rescues with the public if it was a commercial vessel in trouble. But we were the one asset that could reach these folks before they went down, and it worked out. So just an example of mixing the Coast Guard assets.
Yeah, Jeff, thanks for your service on that. Comment on that, Phil?
That sounds very plausible. A lot of times, especially in those, you know, those crappier weather conditions, that's one of the things like the Command Center of Milwaukee takes into account is, you know, which asset can do it safely. And a lot of times, if it is kind of, you know, the weather's uglier like that, we will reach out to one of our Coast Guard cutters. We have 10 of them here in the lake. I've just got a list of them here. You said it was up. He said it was up in Sturgeon Bay. We've got the U.S. Coast Guard Mobile Bay. Actually, a classmate of mine was out on that, and it is very common for, I know you're doing buoy work right now, search and rescue case kind of takes priority. We're going to have to task you to help with that.
I got it. Jeff, thank you again for calling. Appreciate it. Tom in Green Bay, we'll go to you. Hi, Tom.
Good morning. And I got a question for your guest. I see people building boats, and I always wonder before I get on them, has anyone determined what the capacity is? How many people can they take on board? What size of a motor can they put on it? Does the Coast Guard help with that at all?
So the Coast Guard helps with that in the sense that, you know, safety of the public, people out on the water, safety of the waterways is our mission. If you want to go out there and build your own vessel, love the American spirit. I love it. We do offer safety inspections. A lot of times we have an organization called the Coast Guard Auxiliary, who is, first off, is an amazing organization. Everybody that's part of it is amazing because these are people who volunteer their time to go out there, help assist the Coast Guard. And one of the things that they do are those inspections. There are a whole list of regulations based on the size of your vessel, you know, what kind of communication equipment do you have? What kind of lights do you have to have? And that is something that when a Coast Guard does a safety boarding, now you're out there on the water on 4th of July and the Coast Guard boards you, it really is, it's a safety inspection. And that's when we go in and enforce, you know, those safety regulations. But a lot of times reaching out to the auxiliary beforehand, setting up a meeting with them, they will go through and they will check to make sure that your vessel is in compliance with those rules.
Very interesting. Tom, thank you so much for calling. Excuse me. You can join in too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Before we go back to the phones, I know the Coast Guard gets involved in pollution cases. You mentioned that. Could you elaborate on that?
Sure. So the Coast Guard, as part of maintaining the waterways, maintaining natural resources, we work very closely with our state partners. We work very closely with EPA, depending on where it is, what the case is. We are intimately involved in the pollution aspects. For Lake Michigan specifically, we're thinking about, you know, if one of the Lakers starts spilling oil or something as simple as, you know, that sailboat that went down. Okay, we pulled all the people off of the sailboat. Priority number one, we've saved everybody's life. Okay, now we're looking at, you know, it's got 10 gallons of fuel on it. It's got, if it's a larger vessel, it's got 150 gallons of fuel on it. That's something that once the immediate search and rescue aspect is taken away from a case, we're instantly looking at, you know, what is the environmental impacts? Is it down by the Indiana Dunes? Are there any endangered species that are in the area? Piping plover is the one that, you know, the world shuts down for piping plover. But, you know, what is the environmental impact to the area? How best can we mitigate it? And how can we set up for cleanup should worst case scenario happen?
I think Paul in Madison has something that relates to this. Paul, hi. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. Larry. Are the environmental projects primarily maritime based? I mean, that would, you know, be caused by a boat, or do you deal with things that happen on the shore as well?
Thank you for that question. That's a great one. Like I said, we work a lot of times with EPA, but most of the cases that we do deal with are maritime associated. That being said, when I was in Milwaukee as a response officer, part of that is pollution response. And it was Kenosha, and it was an oil spill that actually happened, I think it was like a mile inland. I think it was a gas station or something. But it got into the storm drain. Storm drain fed into the lake. So that was, you know, part of our investigation is, okay, we see the sheen on Lake Michigan. It was actually next to a marina. So we're thinking, you know, is it a vessel that's having this? Looked at it. No, we were able to determine, you know, where it was coming from. Came from a storm drain. And then we actually worked with the city to backtrack that. They've got some folks that can track, you know, where it actually came from. Ended up being from a business downtown, actually. So it really is. It's not so much where it comes from as where it happens.
Very interesting. Maggie and Rhinelander, it's your turn. Hi, Maggie.
Hi. Yeah, Lieutenant, I thought you might get a kick out of this story. My dad grew up on a small dairy farm in Forest County. And before World War II, he wanted to enlist, or actually at the start of it, in the Army Air, well, actually in the Coast Guard. He went down to Chicago, couldn't find the Coast Guard station, so he ended up in the Army Air Corps instead. And, you know, he thought Coast Guard, I'd always have a nice duty station because I'd be on water. And I just thought you might get a kick out of that story since you listened to public radio while you were on a farm. So thank you for your service.
Maggie, thanks very much for calling. Well, there's a good story for you, Phil.
No, I wanted to say thank you very much for sharing that. Rhinelander was, I'm hoping the cheese factory's still there. I haven't been back to Rhinelander in a couple of years. But, yep, grew up on Granddad's dairy farm in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. So, and that story's pretty typical, and that's part of the reason why a lot of people choose the Coast Guard is, you know, where are you being stationed? It's New York City is our largest small boat station. You're on the coast. Typically, wherever you're being stationed is, it's pretty nice.
What kind of training, though, do you go through? I expect it's a military kind of thing. So I expect you got maybe a sort of a military kind of education before you can join.
Yes. So we have a couple of different primary ways to get in. Speaking personally from my personal experience, I went to the Coast Guard Academy. It's in New London, Connecticut, and it's basically our version of West Point. So you go through a period of basic training at the start of it. So you go through a 7-week basic training period, and then you have 4 years of college education interspaced with going out to actual Coast Guard units during your summers. So you don't even get summers off. You're going off and doing more training. As for the enlisted side, we do have an 8-week basic training program that's in New Jersey, Cape May, beautiful area. That was one of my summers, actually, was I was stationed at the small boat station on the training base. But it's, you know, a typical basic, it is a military basic training. There are, you know, regular military indoctrination. You also have, we are a paramilitary organization. We're a law enforcement agency. Part of that is firearms training on our standard issue PD personal defense weapons. But it's also kind of, we're being a nautical service. It is the basics of seamanship as well.
Yeah. Ron in La Crosse, your turn. Hi, Ron.
Yeah, when I was in grade school in the early 60s, the parochial school, we were asked, you know, about the government, and a lot of people thought the Coast Guard was under the Defense Department, but back then it was still under the Treasury Department. The reason, they were supposed to prevent smuggling into the U.S.
Yeah, that you want to give us a little of that history, Phil?
Sure. And he's exactly right. When I was saying the revenue cutter service, it's what is smuggling but an attempt to bring something into the country illegally, avoiding those tariffs. That really was the foundation of the Revenue Cutter Service, which morphed into the Coast Guard. We were under the Department of Treasury, Department of Transportation for a while. Post 9/11 is with the creation of Department of Homeland Security is when we changed into, as it was created, we morphed into that. As for being part of the Department of Defense, we do occasionally in times of war, we will get foldered into the Department of the Navy, and that's just because we are very similar, but we do bring a specific training, mentality, and skill set that the Navy may otherwise not. A lot of the Marine landings in World War II actually were my Coast Guard crews, actually, because, you know, yes, the Navy's really good at driving destroyers out in deep water where they can't run into anything, run aground. Coast Guard, you know, we're a little bit more used to operating in shallow waters. Another one that comes to mind is helicopter pilot rescue during the Vietnam War, actually. Jolly Green Giants is what they were called, where, you know, an Allied fighter pilot would go down, and the Coast Guard were actually the ones pulling them out with the helicopter because they were the ones search and rescue. How do they affect helicopter rescue without actually landing and going through all that process with, you know, that's something we do every day with our rescue swimmers.
Really interesting. Tom from McQuantico emailed to share that his father was in the Coast Guard during World War II. After the war, he used the GI Bill and ROTC to be commissioned in the Army. In college, he met Tom's mother, built a house in Marblehead, Ohio, right behind the Coast Guard station there. Tom says he heard that the station on Lake Erie is the busiest station in the U.S. Is that accurate?
I have, without going in and actually looking at some of those specific numbers for that station, can't say. But like I said, we are one of the busiest districts, but we do it in 3 months. So that would not terribly surprise me if it is one of the most busiest.
I would bet, especially in the summer months, you're the busiest for sure.
Yes.
You can join in too. Number to call 800-642-1234. Or if you'd like Tom, you could email us. Email address talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. The Lake Michigan Command Center in Milwaukee oversees about 350 law enforcement boardings of boats per year. Typically, what prompts officers to want to search a private vessel?
Sure. So a lot of times we will go off, we will do an inspection like that. That is more so tied to the safety. We'll go in, like I said, there's a whole list of regulations, you know, number of fire extinguishers you have to have, sound signal capabilities, things like that. And that is kind of what most of those inspections are. That being said, we do get quite a few calls of, hey, I'm sitting just outside the marina. I see another vessel that is, you know, it's waking everybody out. I see the driver actively drinking at the wheel. And we'll respond to those cases. There was one in the lock of Chicago. So, you know, we're sitting there with all these different boats. They're raising the water to match it. And a pontoon next to us was having a party, and we watched the driver, you know, down three shots while sitting there. Yeah, we pulled him over. He didn't even make it out of the lock.
Oh, man. Olivia in Dubuque, Iowa. We go to you now. Hi, Olivia.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. My husband and I lived in Southeast Alaska for approximately 18 years in both Indian communities as well as in the capital city, Juneau. And we had a lot of experience with Coast Guard people. We have never been personally rescued, but we knew people who were. I do have an interesting story about Coast Guardmen stationed on lighthouse stations. Back in the 60s, they had a one of Five Finger Lighthouse was a manned Coast Guard station. It wasn't automated yet, manned. And there are five Coast Guardmen stationed on this lighthouse for 1 year. And they could get off and go fishing within a mile of the lighthouse. But they couldn't leave unless they got sick and had to be flown to Juneau for medical. So they were there 1 year. We were going by to visit one time, and we got a call from them. Their supply boat forgot to bring cigarettes, and they were out of cigarettes on this lighthouse station. They were desperate. And so we had a group that was going to stop by there and do a singing performance for them. And they said, bring cigarettes. So we got cigarettes, and we had a Christian youth group was coming to sing to them. And they, when they got the boat up to the stairway up to the lighthouse, they said, did you bring the cigarettes? And we said, yes. And so anyway, the kids got up. There were about 25 in the group. There were five Coast Guardmen. They got their cigarettes. They put five chairs out, and this group sang to them. And then we left and went on our way. So it was fun.
Probably don't get those kind of requests anymore, Phil.
We get a lot of odd requests, but nothing quite like that. I'm sure that was a performance that they will never forget. I was stationed up in Kodiak, Alaska for my first tour, actually, and Juneau, beautiful area pulling in. That really is, it's very interesting to see how different the mission set up there is than D9 here in the Great Lakes, but it's all the same. We're all trained to that same standard. So we'll pull people from around the country. And yeah, the mission's a little bit different, but because they go through that training process, the training process is the same for everybody. We can pull people from different responses or for different things, put them into the case, and they can perform wonderfully.
Olivia, thank you so much for calling. We're visiting today, having a really good time talking with Lieutenant Philip Gertler. He's the public affairs officer for the 9th U.S. Coast Guard District, responsible for all Coast Guard operations on and surrounding the Great Lakes. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. We're taking a look at the Coast Guard and its operations, especially in Lake Michigan and Superior, but the Coast Guard, the 9th District, operates in all of our Great Lakes. So it's great to have our guest, Lieutenant Philip Gertler, with us. He's the public affairs officer in the 9th U.S. Coast Guard District. Great to have him with us. You can join in, 800-642-1234, email to talk@wpr.org. Let's go to Jane in Manitowoc next. Hi, Jane.
Hello, Larry. Thank you for another great show. Philip, first I want to thank you for your service. And as a retired Army and retired County Veteran Service Officer, please encourage your members to check out their VA benefits. I had Coast Guard guys come in the office that would go, well, I'm not sure I'm eligible for VA. And it's like, yes, you are. You serve this nation, especially if you have any injuries or illnesses due to exposures in service. So please encourage them to reach out to the County Veteran Service Office. Thank you so much for your time. And again, thank you for your service.
Thank you, Jane. Comment on that, Philip?
One, thank you very much for that. Really appreciate the support of you and our county veteran affairs offices. That is one thing that a lot of people, Coast Guard, oh, that's not military. No, we still are part of the military. We are entitled to those benefits. And it's interesting, one thing that I love about D9 is how intertwined we are with the community. So Lake Michigan specifically, we've got Grand Haven Festival. Grand Haven is the Coast Guard city every year. They hold a huge festival for us. We really appreciate it. We get the cutters out there. We get some of the helicopters out there, and it's really a great time. Sturgeon Bay is also a Coast Guard city. We actually just were renewing their certification as a Coast Guard city. So the support of the communities is really what allows us to be as effective as we are, and we couldn't do it without that support.
And I'm sure, well, I hope at least, that the Coast Guard is reminding its members about the benefits, as Jane was talking about. The eligibility for benefits is very important.
Yes, that is. Actually, every member, when they leave the service, there is a class that they have to go through. It is required before you leave the service, and that is one of the things that they spend a couple of days covering is, you know, how does that process look? Where do you get it from?
Brian in Madison was curious about whether the Coast Guard deals with piracy or robbery of boats on the Great Lakes.
So fortunately, knock on wood here, that is one of those missions that we do a little bit. We really don't have too much here in the Great Lakes for. However, the beauty of the Coast Guard is if you join and that's something you want to go out there and fight piracy, we have units that's primarily what they do. So a lot of the patrols that come out of, you know, the Gulf of Mexico down south like that, that is one of their primary missions. But D9, fortunately, like I said, knock on wood,
yeah,
that's a little bit smaller. We deal with a lot less of those.
That's a good thing. Let's go to Aaron in Oshkosh next. Hi, Aaron.
Yes, hello, gentlemen. Thank you so much for taking my phone call. I mean this in the truest, most genuine nature, but this is kind of like the X-Files, Fox Mulder thing. Being as District 9 deals with all of the Great Lakes, it's a two-part question, please. What is the strangest call that our individual here has ever had to respond to or is aware of, and have they ever responded or are they aware of anything having to do with like a lake monster? Think of Nelly, you know, for instance, because I've lived on a couple of the Great Lakes and I actually have a couple of very interesting stories that I personally have been witness to, and I would love to hear the response, and thank you so much.
All right, Aaron, thank you. So two-part question there, Philip.
All right. So I'm going to start with the second question. To my knowledge, I'm absolutely positive that somewhere there's been a report of, you know, Nessie or something of that like, but I've never seen or heard of one. I did have one of my ETs request an exorcism for a machine one time. That's about as close to monsters as I've ever seen. As for the weirdest case that call that I ever got was a gentleman, can talk very broadly here, going through a divorce. His wife, his then ex-wife, got the boat. He tried to go out and sink the boat to spite her. You know, we pulled up onto it. Fortunately, it was a cork-filled boat, so even if you know, drilling holes in it, it wasn't sinking. So we talk about what gets you, you know, what causes a Coast Guard crew to come over and do a safety inspection. You're sitting there with a drill poking holes in your own boat. Yeah, we're gonna chat with you.
Oh boy!
So that was,
and he didn't realize it would sink even if he poked holes in it.
Yes. So he got. We pulled up. No, you can't just sink your boat anywhere. You have to, if you want to get rid of it, you got to properly dispose of it. Again, some of that pollution concerns. You know, if you sink it in a channel, there's major concerns with that. So they towed him in. It was a whole thing, and then there was the wife's lawyer was trying to prove that he was destroying the property. A whole mess. But yes, do not try to sink your boat off of a beach. Thank you.
Is there any requirement? I know in some lakes, for example, I know someone whose car was driving his car out on the lake. And the ice broke, and the lake went to the bottom, and he was required to get that boat or that car out of the lake, which was a very expensive little process involving scuba divers and, you know, winter and so forth. Is there anything law like that regarding, you know, something, you drop your boat and your boat sinks in Lake Michigan, are you responsible for anything in terms of getting it out or costs associated?
You know, every case is going to, it very much is a case-by-case basis, but it does, you know, what constitutes a pollution incident for us, it's basically one drop of oil. It's anything that causes a sheen. And I don't know if you've ever dropped a drop of oil, but it goes out there. But it really is kind of a case-by-case basis. You know, is it intentional? Are they trying to get it out? But yes, strictly speaking, there is a duty. We call it whenever there's a pollution case like this, we call it the responsible party to rectify the situation. That could be something of, you know, the vessel sank in the middle of the lake. You know, is it possible to recover it? Two, if we go in and it's, you know, it's deep enough where it's not going to cause an issue to other boats, you know, a danger, do you just go in and you have to recover the, you know, remove the pollution? Is that enough? That's when I say that we've got those units that that's their specialty is, you know, this is what happened. This is what the situation we're looking at. What are the options going forward?
Yeah. Well, like that guy we were talking about earlier with his sailboat, I mean, that sailboat went down in 300 feet of water.
Mm-hmm. And a small sailboat like that, it's not going to have a huge internal fuel tank. You know, it's a case-by-case basis. I'm not sure the status of that one, but,
yeah,
you know, you can only do what you can do.
I got to believe the 4th of July weekend is a busy time. And what do you have for it? You know, when people like to be out on the water and you have a boating safety division, what preventive measures do you have for promoting a way to reduce loss of injuries and life from boating on the Great Lakes?
Biggest thing is, you know, boat responsibly. A lot of people, they don't realize that, you know, if you are operating a boat under the influence, that is a crime, both state and federally. We will come after you. We will find you, and we'll come after you, and we'll arrest you potentially for it. But while boating under the influence, and life jackets. You know, technically you're supposed to have a life jacket for every person on board. You know, if the boat sinks and it splits in half and there's a disaster, yeah, it's great you had the life jacket, you know, stowed in the compartment down below, locked, and you forgot it was there. Really, wearing the life jackets, no, it's not. We totally understand that it's not fashionable, but that is really what's going to keep you alive until help can get to you. And then thirdly, how does help get to you? Well, we have to know that there's an incident, whether that's cell phones, which may be limited in range once you start getting further outside of shore. Primary is going to be channel 16 on VHF radio. We have folks at those command centers that are monitoring channel 16 24/7. And we have the capability of, you know, somebody jumps on there and says, Mayday, we can actually triangulate that position. And that is a huge help for us because we know, okay, they made a call at this time. They're here. They're somewhere in this vicinity.
Yeah.
So those are really three big things is, no alcohol, drugs while driving a boat, wearing your life jacket, communication.
Lieutenant Philip Girdler, you do a great job. Thank you so much for your service and for being with us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much for the opportunity. Like I said, I'm happy to be able to give back to WPR after all the good that they've done for Wisconsin and myself personally.
Phil, thank you so much. Philip Girdler, Lieutenant, Public Affairs Officer for the 9th U.S. Coast Guard District, responsible for all Coast Guard operations on and surrounding the Great Lakes. I learned a lot. I hope you did, too. Coming up next, we'll take a look at weather and climate with our weather guys. I'm Larry Mehler.